This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Michael Stevens, an associate professor in the School of Information at San Jose State University and the author of Wholehearted Librarianship. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from listeners just like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com/support. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much for asking me back. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's been a couple of years since you were on the show, and the last time you were on was in the wake of the 2016 elections, and the mood of the country was a little chaotic and disoriented, and it's still that way a little bit in certain circles. Can you talk about how the political and social environment over the past couple of years has helped to shape your empathy-driven approach to librarianship?
Well, absolutely. And the subtitle of the new collection, Finding Hope, Inspiration, and Balance, I think, we all need a little bit of all of those things, especially hope. Empathy started finding its way into my teaching and my presentations and my writing, probably around that time, a couple, 3 years ago, when I made the shift a little bit to talking about soft skills and what we need to do information work in kind of chaotic times. And as you said, the first book came out maybe before chaos even seemed to get even more prominent, globally in the US for sure, but globally. And I guess I sort of found, or I decided to bring out more of the touchy-feely side of my stuff, which I've realized in looking at student evaluations of my classes and talking to people after presentations, that it really is, it's like about people and it's about feelings and it is about the heart. And it is about things like love, which is kind of makes people uncomfortable to talk about. Love and empathy and joy and all of those things. So and I'm just thrilled with the way this collection came together.
It's interesting to look at this collection of old blog posts and columns because the empathy in your work has been there all the way back. It may be more emphasized now, but it's always been there. And that connection between the patron and the library in a heartfelt kind of way, not just in a, hey, I've got things, let me lend them to you kind of way.
Yeah. Well, that part going back to really 2005 to 2009, that was super interesting to me. And those, the ones that we pulled, and we should say that this was writing done for ALA TechSource. I was one of the first of the four original TechSource bloggers, Jenny Levine, Tom Peters, and Karen Schneider. And she wrote the foreword to the book. Thank you, Karen. We were, it was kind of a big deal to be blogging for ALA, and we were all encouraged to kind of find our voice under the banner of ALA and write about this stuff. And we all sort of, we wrote about what was happening then, and looking back, I pulled the ones for this collection that were kind of the timeless ones. And it's fascinating to see that stuff we were talking about then, we are still talking about in slightly different ways. Mm-hmm. But I guess the philosophy is still there. And the library is human. The library encourages the heart. It's absolutely the same thing. And in this collection and the new stuff I wrote is about taking care of each other. And that's exactly what the library encourages the heart means.
Yes, and even outside of a few dated references to iPods and, quote, the upcoming tablet from Apple, you're right that they're timeless and can be read at any time. You also talk a little bit about Netflix in a few of the columns, which when you wrote about them was still just shipping DVDs, I think, without streaming. But now with everything streaming, library access to a lot of content has been diminished. We don't have access to Netflix originals or Amazon originals, and are not likely to. Netflix, Amazon, Disney Plus, they're not going to have a library product for us. And a lot of Disney content now is just completely out of our out of what we can get, outside of some DVDs that they'll probably continue to produce for a while at least. But you also talk about, outside of that stuff, that why it's important that libraries embrace the concept of helping patrons create their own content, create stuff for themselves.
Right. I looked at that too to get ready for this. And my talking about the AV department, because I started in the AV department in 1991 at the St. Joseph County Public Library in South Bend, Indiana. And well, is it, you know, we do everything is streaming, right? But movies are still going out, right? And I haven't looked to see, like, are CDs still going out? I honestly don't know the answer to that. I go to the Traverse City Library and I get music on occasion. But it is super interesting to see how much has gone to right to your home. Like, we're watching Mindhunter right now. Netflix. You know, that's the only way really to get that. So that is super interesting. But there's still, yeah, and what you said about Disney and all of that going away from the libraries, like, will that happen when Criterion launches? And I've heard they're doing this, right? Or, yeah, you know, right. Will all those things start going away?
In the era you were first writing these columns, the internet age was still really just dawning and things were changing so quickly. But there was an openness to things. Your friend Michael Casey passed along a question about how all of the early library bloggers seemed connected and open with each other and a community. And that community feeling really isn't around as much in the social media age we live in now. Michael's question was, do you miss that feeling of the old days of library blogging, those library 2.0 days?
Great question. And I'm going to give you a very honest answer. I am thrilled with that time and starting Tame the Web and everything that happened because of Tame the Web and everything I did probably related to all of that writing and writing for ALA Tech Source, and that led to Library Journal. That said, you know, that's that thing I look back, well, yeah, yay, that was great. And I love that time, but I am very happy with the way things are now. And I think for me, and I'm older, I'll be 55 next year. So, you know, you go back, you know, that was a different time. So now I'm like, maybe I'm looking at the world a little bit differently. I don't live and breathe libraries as much as I did, but I still do to a certain extent because it's my job and it's my calling and my teaching and all of that. But I think, to go back to your earlier question, I think that's one of the reasons in this collection I really wanted to pull out this thing about taking care of each other, about being human, and just sort of that getting that balance between all the tech and all the everything. So, you know, yay for that time. And what a great question from Michael. I appreciate it. Where is that happening now? It's probably happening on some of the Facebook groups, Twitter, you know, to a certain degree, the librarians on Twitter, but then sometimes some of that seems to go a little awry. Right. And I do a lot of sharing. Maybe I'm not diving in as much as I would have a few years ago. But yeah, the conversations are there. They're different. And I think one of the reasons, because everything was so new, 10, almost 15 years ago now, like there was one time when whatever it was, probably in the middle of all the library 2.0 stuff, that I was like, somebody really launched into me and maybe, you know, to Michael and some of the other proponents, if you will. And, actually, the assistant director of the library came up to me the next morning and she's like, are you okay? And wow, you know, that she was aware that it happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. And I guess that's when I realized that my skin had thickened up a bit. yeah, but it's so interesting because how new that was. And now, you know, it seems like it happens everywhere. Like never... you know, don't be that guy that does something stupid that a million people are going to video and put on YouTube or whatever. And then, you know, you get famous and they give you a nickname or whatever. Never be those people.
You also talk about the importance of self-care in the book. Can you talk about that concept a little more?
Right. I wrote the epilogue to wind things up and to come back to that idea of taking care. I was at the Asia Pacific Library and Information Conference. I did the keynote there. It was in Broad Beach, Australia, which is in Queensland. And the jet lag and this, it was so beautiful there on the ocean. I was up super early every day walking, and I would see other people from the conference walking on the beach. And I spoke to one lady and she said, "Yeah, it's so good to get out and breathe." And I said, "Yeah, yeah." And that kind of found its way into the book, and this idea of taking care of ourselves and doing those things that help us recharge and help us maybe kind of reset our brains a little bit. And that's something that's, I think I've been working on that like a lot this last summer as well, just to breathe and to be out and forest bathing, if you will, which like two or three people have said that in the last week about forest bathing. We do need to take care of ourselves first. And that's why I kind of hinted at that earlier when I said living and breathing libraries, and yay for these, like the librarians, the new graduates, the folks that I'm seeing that are on fire on Twitter and in the Facebook groups that are just tearing it up. Yay for them. What I would say to them is that's great. Keep going. Do all these wonderful things. Be out there writing and speaking and everything, but take care of yourselves too. 10 years ago, you know, in the midst of all the everything going on, there were days like I would get back from the airport and have to go back to the airport in like 2 or 3 days. And wow, and again, I'm glad I lived through all of that. But wow, yeah, we need to take care of ourselves.
I'm glad you made that connection back, because libraries can be and probably should be one of the most important things in your life, but they are not the only thing important in your life, family and friends and our animal friends and all this stuff. But I also noticed when looking back in the book that you get a lot of your inspiration from others. A lot of the pieces start with, "I was at a conference and heard this person and it got me thinking, ... So what's inspiring you today? Who's inspiring you today? You talk in these old columns about Seth Godin and David Weinberger, Clue Train Manifesto, all that. But who's inspiring you now?
I just re-recorded a set of lectures. And to do that, I sort of updated a lot of those things. I revisited the Clue Train, but I also added on some stuff that sort of extended it, bringing it forward. So now, nowadays... Okay, we'll take a little tiny tangent here, and I will tell you, I am like the podcast guy. Like all summer long, I listen to podcasts, all different kinds, and I am just fascinated by all the thinking and all the discussions and just all the content coming out. So that, and just like re-recording these lectures, I realized I was like, talking like podcast guy too, because it's kind of a different way. If you listen to 100 hours of something, you're going to start talking a little bit like that. Okay. Things that I'm super interested in these days, beyond podcasts, which I'm doing, like, you know, various things, personal interests, and then some of the technology stuff, and then some of the stuff just about people, This American Life. And I'm really in tune with anything that's going to tell me about somebody's story. I think that's mm-hmm. so powerful. And then in the library world, I've been looking at sort of more on a global scale these days. We have things going on at the School of Information where we really want students to have be exposed to global thinking, what's going on in other parts of the world with libraries. So that's one reason I've also been able to do some really cool stuff around the world. So things like Doc One Library in Aarhus, Next Library Conference, the folks down in Australia doing things. I got to meet Christian Lorsen, I hope I said that right, and mm-hmm. Marie, who are running Library Planet, which is a super interesting thing. I just wrote a column about them called The World Spins a few months ago. And that's one of my, again, another little aside, I sneak in song lyrics or Twin Peaks references as often as I can. And The World Spins is a song by Julie Cruise that was used in Twin Peaks. But it fits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You also write a lot about your international travels to New Zealand and Denmark and all this. What kind of things have you learned from libraries in other countries? And what do you feel like they've learned from you about American libraries?
Well, I guess because I was at Next Library this last summer in Denmark, that one's probably at the forefront of my mind. And that conference is amazing for bringing people together from all over the world. So you get to hear all sorts of ideas, and they do Ignite talks. So you get that like 5-minute quick thing, which is super cool, as well as the workshops. And what was super interesting to me was some of the workshops or sessions that I attended. One was on smart cities, where we left the library and walked around the downtown area. And I learned about things like smart trash cans. I had no idea that there are smart trash cans that will like sort of know when they should be picked up and what's in them. And you know, that we had conversations about privacy and what does that mean. And it was just fascinating to walk around outside. So it was with city planners and library folk. Mm-hmm. So anytime you get into a situation where you're a little bit out of your comfort zone and the topic is like, I don't know anything about this. That's the thing to go for. And that's like what I've discovered at Next Library, and really in like even being in Australia last year, getting to talk to library folk all over the National Library of Australia and up in Townsville. There's things that are coming over, like we've seen, and with your library, the open library, kind of that thinking. And mm-hmm. it's really interesting because that's kind of ramping up globally. It's really interesting to see how that's like put out. Like Gwinnett did it super well. Like, we're doing this to give people more access to the collection. We are not cutting staff. Nowhere was that talked about. Other places, other countries, it might be because staff have had to be cut. So I like to see that coming over here and see like that twist on it. And I think we should see more of that in the U.S. for communities that can make it work. Absolutely. Back to Next Library. I did a session with two ladies from Australia and an academic librarian from North Carolina called The Power of Stories. And we knew what was going to happen, but we didn't know what was going to happen. And it was the most amazing thing. And I have a piece coming out in Library Journal. It's going to be a two-parter because so much happened about us coming together. And what I learned specifically from the Australians, Kylie Carlson, and Felicity, I'm sorry, your last name just went out of my head. They have done services for children on the autism spectrum, sensitive story times, sensitive Santa, where the family with the child gets to meet Santa in the library. And it was just so amazing to see the level of sharing and openness going on in that session. And then all the folks that attended got to share their own stories of how libraries change lives. It was super duper cool.
Can you talk about the importance of personal learning experiences, professional development?
Well, if we say we're a learning organization, then we have to actually be a learning organization. And that means things should be formalized. And we'll come back to that. But professional learning experiences, or just learning experiences for the entire staff, I've long advocated for that. And what we're coming off of now, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about my research, and I promise it won't be boring. I did a study in the United States of public librarians and paraprofessionals. How do you learn? how do you learn for your jobs? And of course, I'm much more of a qualitative researcher than a quantitative. Statistics are hard, but to get somebody's story, that's the thing that really appeals to me. And I think that should be the power of research these days, is telling people's story. So I asked them, you know, what impedes you from learning in your job? And what would be the perfect way you could learn? What impedes beyond budget and time? And that was actually built into the question, beyond money and time, what impedes your learning? And it was, the things that rose to the top were things like lack of a formalized program. All those people over there get to go to ALA every year, but I don't, and I don't understand how that works. And then, what would be the perfect thing for your learning? This is so interesting to me. People want to go to conferences, of course, but they also want to be maybe in a small group, maybe 20 or so, go on retreat of some kind and solve problems. They want it to be active, they want to be sharing, and they want to be doing something that actually has results. That was super duper interesting to me. I did a little bit about that at the last couple of ALAs, which was super fun, New Orleans and then DC. And then the other thing, and this is, we got to get this coming out, is I interviewed, we did a similar study in Australia with Helen Partridge and Kate Davis at the University of Southern Queensland. And I did a series of interviews of Australian librarians to see how they learn. And this was working with a student at San Jose. Her name's Greta Snyder. She and I, she helped me with the data. We did a narrative inquiry study where I asked them one question. Tell me your story about how you learned for your job. And it's absolutely fascinating. We're going to have three personas out that sort of sum up how various library staff folks learn. As it stands right now, the three personas are the self-driven go-getter, and maybe some listeners are like, oh, that's me. That's how I learned for my job. The curious introvert, maybe a little more quiet about things, maybe a little more subtle. And to go back to Next Library, they shake it up. You cannot be super introverted at Next Library because they want you talking and they want you on your feet and they want you yelling and singing and doing all kinds of things. Anyway, the third one is the excluded cynic who feels, oh, there's no support for my learning, so I guess I'm doing it all on my own. So this, we're going to get this submitted in for a publication, and we'll get that out there for sure.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. It's good to keep that kind of research going.
Super interesting. Super duper interesting.
Now, I really enjoyed your column about emojis. What made you want to write a column about that? And let me say, I do love that Library Journal lets you do the title of the column as a series of emojis itself.
Which, yeah, was fun. And I like that it carried over into the book. I was fascinated by that study that I wrote about. And there's another one, I think, open in a tab here on my computer that I need to come back to about, you know, where emojis are at right now. I'm going to be doing a staff development day later on, based on this book, which I'm super excited about. And one of the things we're going to do, and I just had a little meeting about this, and this was their idea, and I can't wait to do this, is the staff as groups are going to tell stories with printed out emojis. They're going to build a story. So how cool is that? And what that points toward is, again, recognizing that there are different ways to communicate. And, you know, where will we be in 50 years? You know, where, you know, will there be more emojis like out at the airport? Because everybody knows what, you know, that symbol means and that symbol means. And I remember, and I, you know, you kind of want to, sometimes you want to rattle the cage a little bit. In one of my talks, after that column came out, I said, well, you know, for those of us in graduate school, someday will, you know, the big graduate project, could it be all visually based? Not that somebody's going to write a paper in emoji. That would be super interesting. But something that is like more visual than anything else. And then how do you grade that if you have certain standards for citations and grammar and all of those things? It's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, and I've seen several examples of people doing their dissertations in a graphic novel, a sequential art format.
That is super cool.
So for our last question, I wanted to go back. I know the last question I asked you last time was the Fleetwood Mac one, and I thought it was a good one. And it really got, I think, a good answer from you. So I was trying to think of something else. I try to top myself and get a good final question for you. And so I kind of thought about, well, what do I know about Michael? What do I know is important to him? And so let's wrap up with dogs, because I know dogs are important to you. And you write about it in the book, too. So it ties back to the book. You write about your dog, Jake, one in particular, where the two of you kind of grew up on the internet together.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that experience? And then I know you've had and unfortunately lost a couple of other sweet dogs in the years since. But just dogs in general, and I know you connect with, how does that relationship with dogs kind of guide your viewpoint, not necessarily in librarianship, but just in the world in general, your kind of philosophical view of the world? I know that's kind of a big question.
No, I appreciate it. Jake was my first Labrador, and that I did not do very well after he died in 2007. So writing that piece probably a few months later was one of the ways I was trying to kind of make peace with it. But it was super cool because he was always in my slides. What then found its way later on in the book is the piece about Dozer, the rescue dog.
Yes.
And people were coming up to me because that hit Library Journal. And then at like walking in the concourse at ALA, somebody would say, "Oh, how's Dozer?" that was amazing. And having him, and really all of the dogs, they look to you unconditionally. They don't judge, you know. It's rather amazing. And to think about that as a leader or in libraries, or just, you know, the empathy is there, the understanding that, oh yeah, here's Dozer. He's blind in one eye. He was heartworm positive when we got him. He has a lot of stuff wrong with his little body, but he's the sweetest guy ever. You know, that does translate to kind of understanding, oh yeah, we're serving all sorts of people and we need to understand where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote Dozer's epilogue, a little bit tacked onto the column about him. He got bone cancer and passed in the spring of 2018. So we had him for 26 months and we thought it was going to be like 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Then that was hard and it was. And then Cooper this year, as the book was at the point where they were putting it together, Cooper got sick, liver cancer, and passed within about 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's why his name is in the dedication too. That was kind of rough.
Yeah.
But wow. Yeah. And right now we're dogless, but that will, you know, eventually there'll be another dog or two. There's something about rescuing a dog. But there is so much there, I think, about leadership, about how we conduct ourselves. And, you know, they say you can tell a dog person and that person usually turns out to be super duper cool. So you know, there's something, and animal people in general. And that's how we you know, broadened out the column back then. So, okay. I will say, just to come back to forest bathing, mm-hmm. we have dear friends up here who have rescued and helped and adopted dogs that are older and ill and et cetera. And they have the biggest hearts in the world. And Darren and Rhonda, they're wonderful people.
And we went over to their place a few days ago, 7 dogs. And I said, I'm coining a new term. I'm calling this dog bathing. It's a different than giving a dog a bath, but this is for me and for my heart to sit with their sweet dog named Remy and just kind of be, you know, it's comforting and it's sweet. And it brought back memories of sitting with Cooper and with Dozer and with Jake and with Charlie. So it's a good thing. So, and find that, and let's kind of broaden out to taking care of yourself. For me, it's taking care of a dog, and it's walking in the woods. It's those things, and it's music, and it's good TV shows that challenge me. Find that thing, and it might be sports, and it might be hiking, it might be whatever. Find that thing that does to your heart what dog bathing or being with dogs does for me, or listening to your favorite song, All I Ever Wanted Was to Know That You Were Dreaming. Do those things because it will help you. It will help you in your job. It will help you be a person. Maybe this is a little off the subject of dogs, but I will go back to one other thing, if this is okay, Steve.
Yeah.
One thing I have learned from the summer of listening to a billion podcasts is we need to talk to each other, and we need to be open, and we need to talk about things like, yes, I have depression, and yes, I have anxiety sometimes. We need to bring these things out from behind being embarrassed about them. And the more we do that, and absolutely in the workplace, as much as you're comfortable to talk with the people that you work with, that, yeah, I am dealing with whatever it might be, grief over losing a dog, just, you know, things happening at home. We need to talk more about these things because I think a lot of people feel that way. And the more we talk about it, I think the better, the more that it helps.
Yeah. And I feel like if you feel like it's too personal, you don't want to share, you don't have to share all the details of something, you know, you can just share. Like,
right.
I mean, I have depression and anxiety. I don't have to tell you the reasons why those get triggered sometimes. And, you know, you don't need to know everything going on in my family or everything going on in my life. But sometimes it helps just to say, I'm having a hard time right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just so people know you're having a hard time. And that just helps to share. Yeah.
I that's one thing I really appreciate about Facebook right now. And maybe it's some of the groups that I'm in. But some people will say, I am having a hard time. Post a picture of your dog or cat, mm-hmm. or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. Yeah, we need more of that. And it needs to carry over into life, too.
Yeah, so, I can say beyond on the receiving end of that sometimes, too, if you post something like that, it does make you feel better to see a little picture of a manatee smiling and waving at you sometimes. I mean, just those little cute things on the internet sometimes that you kind of roll your eyes at sometimes. When you need it, you need it, and it helps.
Absolutely.
Well, Michael, I think one of the things that also can help if you're thinking of these things in library terms is your book, Wholehearted Librarianship. Because I think it's a good thing to just kind of, I think Karen mentions that in the preface as well, that you can read it straight through if you want, but I think it's better almost of just picking a topic that you want to hear about, you want to read about and get inspired about, and read an individual thing about that, and you can just get a little, you know, they're all short. You can just take a few minutes to read one and come out inspired and a little more upbeat, I think. So thank you for writing the book and putting it together.
Thank you. Thank you for this conversation. I appreciate it.
If people want to follow up with you and converse and keep that conversation going, how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, you can you can find me on Twitter, mstevens7. People can email me. That's cool. We'll get that in the show notes. That's a podcast term. Is that okay to say it that way?
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm on Instagram, all those things, and we can link to Tame the Web where those things are.
Okay. That's it. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Yeah. Thank you.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. You can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening and keep circulating your ideas. Yeah, and this is a podcast, but we're not going to talk about Squarespace or Casper mattresses or anything like that.
Promo code murder.